Morusan Bonani, hello. How's it? Welcome to another installment of the Liberty and Friends podcast. I'm your host, Big Daddy Liberty. And of course, this show is brought to you by the Big Liberty Show in conjunction with the Institute of Race Relations. Guys, welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed the topic last week. We had, if you remember, Mr. Nicholas Babaya, who is a writer and analyst at the IRR. He just recently joined us. And he is, you know, when you want to talk all things China, Nick is your man. So go ahead and listen to that podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed it. This week I have a cracker of a guest for you guys. But before I get to my guest, let me have my usual 5-minute rant. And I'll make it a short one because I've got someone who can rant just as well as I can in studio. Guys, some of the big news items that you've probably been checking out and that you know I'm excited about if you've been watching my other shows is the deal of the century, Mr. Trump's approach towards the Middle East peace plan. Now, you guys know I've been talking about this for a very long time, and I echo some of the sentiments of key thinkers on this issue who've basically said, if you don't understand what one side of that debate, if you will, wants to do to the other side, namely the Palestinian, the so-called Palestinian cause, which a lot of people sort of mask in the language of victimhood. Oh, the poor Palestinians. If only, you know, excuse me, if only the evil Israelis got out of the way, the Palestinians would do so well. That's just simply not true. If you do not have a government that follows the rule of law, that appreciates civil liberties, that creates an environment that allows individuals in that society, wherever you are in the world, to thrive, then you will not have sort of prosperity, the sort of peace that is required to build societies. Now, what do I mean by this? Have a look at the rest of the Arab world. The rest of the Arab world has essentially done exactly what I'm suggesting, to varying degrees. I'm not saying they're free societies, not all of them at least, but they've erred on the side of more progressive freedoms for individuals. I mean, look at Saudi Arabia. If we were having this conversation 20 years ago, no one would have believed that a new leader would have ushered in some reforms that we're beginning to see come through there that are improving their society. That's the first argument. The second argument is, economically, the rest of the Arab world is doing really well. You know, a lot of these countries obviously have the God-given endowment of oil, but they haven't stopped there. They've used the oil to build up savings. At an individual level, there's been a wonderful distribution of income, not a redistribution, a distribution of income. In other words, people have found work, they've invested their income in providing good education, good health care, the very things that individuals need to be able to become competitive, to enter the economy. And what have they done with that? They have societies now that have largely middle-income individuals. And you've seen a commensurate rise in the living standards in the past part of the world. Now, look at it. If you're an Arab nation, as I've just described now, where there's a high level of high standard of living, you're very connected to the rest of the world. I mean, some of these places are literally travel hubs, international travel hubs now. If you're living in a society like that, and then you look at what's happening in so-called Palestine, and the people there are still holding on to the rhetoric, the Arab rhetoric of the 60s, of being victims, of not being able to progress and prosper, you're thinking, why though? If the rest of us are doing so well, why? And a lot of you are thinking, oh, of course you'll say that, Sikhli, you're a Zionist. Of course, you look at it through rose-tinted eyes, but look at the record. When this deal by Donald Trump came out, some of the loudest voices in support of it were Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Oman. They came out and said, yes, this is the beginning of the sort of peace plan that we want for this region. It talks about prosperity by offering 50 billion rands worth of investment to the Palestinians. Now, this is not donations. This is not... excuse me, guys. I got a frog in my throat. This is not donations. This is not aid. It's actual investment into infrastructure, into creating jobs, industry, the very sort of things that you need as a society. Again, moving away from viewing Palestinians as victims and actually basically saying, if you guys can get your act together in the next 4 years, abandon the terrorist likes of Hamas, abandon the violence, and come to the table, this 50 billion rand, in and amongst other things, is waiting for you. An actual nation, finally the Palestinians can have a nation for themselves, is actually waiting for you. And it is you, the ordinary Palestinian, who get to decide your leadership, not terrorist organizations like Hamas or Islamic Jihad. You, the ordinary citizen. Why would you not want that? Why would that not be something you envision as being absolutely necessary for the home, the establishment of a home, sorry, of a Palestinian people who live who live side by side with the Israelis? That is the two-state solution that we've been talking about forever. Now, if you're someone who doesn't want peace in that part of the world, who wants to see the war, who wants to see the rockets, who wants to see Israelis, you know, with high walls and the like, then yeah, you won't want any peace. You won't want any deal. You'll talk about Trump being totally useless and not doing anything to help in that region. But think about. I'll leave you with this. Stop believing what the media tell you about this deal. You cannot tell me a president who everybody maligns, who everybody treats as an absolute joke. You can't tell me that a guy, that same guy, comes with a deal and is able to convince Arab countries who just 40 years ago were fighting a war against that country, ready to annihilate it, ready to actually get rid of the Jewish state. You can't tell me that a guy who's brought those countries to be able to say, yeah, we accept this deal, we want it, it'll bring peace to the region. You can't tell me that guy doesn't know what he's doing. Now, I'm not praising Trump in all other things. I think he's a statist, he's blown the deficit in America, spending is still just as out of control, in my view, as any other president. There's good and a bad to everybody, as I always say, like, love his tax cuts, but spending is still out of control. But on this particular foreign policy issue, he has my full support in actually bringing peace to that part of the world and bringing something different. So that's my rant, my 5-minute rant. I hope you enjoyed it. I didn't, because there's still no peace in that part of the world. And I don't think, for as much as this deal is as good as I suggested it, that the Palestinian leadership will actually come to the table. So it's really the ball's in the hands of the Palestinian people themselves. They need to be the ones who insist on good governance, an abandonment of terrorism, the abandonment of corruption, the eradication of the poverty that they live in. I mean, it's unacceptable in the 21st century that those people surrounded by prosperity are still living like that. And it really is up to them. So I hope they take it up. Kudos to the Americans, and I will keep you guys updated on this issue as and when it pops up. But back to my guest. As soon as I come back from this break, I'm going to be having a conversation with Mr. Darby Ruart, who, of course, is from the Efficient Group out here in Pretoria. It's hot as hell up here, but the conversation will be even hotter. Molo Sanbonani, welcome back. I'm your favorite fat boy, Big Daddy Liberty, and I said I am joined in my makeshift studio. I'm actually in the offices of the Efficient Group. Please do excuse the bit of the echo. I'll do my level best to get rid of it in post-production. But the conversation itself is still just an absolute gem of a conversation to have. If you've been watching my channel, have a look on YouTube and Facebook. I do have a short snippet interview with Darby Ruart that I did last year, towards the end of the year, and that's up and open to you viewing. And we discussed a few themes there, which I did say would hash out in greater detail. So without me waffling on, let me welcome Mr. Darby Ruart to the channel. Darby, good day to you, my good sir.
Thank you so much. And let me welcome you here at the Efficient Group. We call this the fishbowl.
And it literally is. Darby is describing what is essentially a fishbowl. I feel like a catfish sort of, you know, trolling the bottom of the bowl here. Darby, it's been a very interesting, just even the beginning of the year. It feels like we had 3 years just in January, yeah, and not in itself. Those of us who are broke are happy that January is over. But I want to begin there because there's a story in that, isn't there? The idea that South Africans right now just do not have much in the way of disposable income. I mean, I've been listening to other economists like Mike Schussler, who post a lot on social media, who are actually showing us in real terms, in hard data terms, that South Africans are getting poorer. And we seem to have seen that over December, didn't we? Not much in the way of shopping and economic activity.
Can I get going by maybe just add to what you've just said about why you made a few starting comments. And there's something that I can add to that. And that is that rich people and wealthy people do not fight one another. Successful people do not fight one another. Mm. If you really want to see people fighting one another, if you want to see countries fighting one another, those are countries that are poor, because poverty leads to poverty. Poor people fight one another.
That's right.
If you really want to uplift people, create an environment where you can create wealth and rich people live in peace.
Exactly.
And that's what I want. I want people to live in peace. Unfortunately, that's not the case in South Africa. Yeah, exactly. Because for the past 5 years, if you look at simple, straightforward numbers, the economy hardly grew, but at the same time, the population was growing, and we've been getting poorer for the past 5 years. And I've done some numbers on what can you expect in terms of economic growth, and we can talk a bit about this thing that we call the economy, because that's a very flawed concept. Mm-hmm. Economists don't even understand and agree what should be measured with the economy.
Right.
But at least we know one thing, that it could be wrong, but it's at least consistently wrong. So we call this thing the economy, and the size of the economy is currently increasing at a rate of less than 1%. And I expect it to be increasing at less than that for 2020 and the years thereafter, while the population is growing by 1.6%. Now, if you increase wealth by, say, 1%, which is not the case, but you increase the number of people that need to share in this wealth by 1.6% every year, it's very easy to understand that poverty will go up, and with that, unemployment will go up as well. So that's what we've had. We've had five horrible, miserable years. And this year is going to be another one, and the next year is going to be one as well. And that means increase in unemployment, the poverty on that. And this leads, and you can feel it. You can feel the social tension. You can feel the political tension building up. And that's going to, and that leads to all sort of wacko people with funny ideas about politics and economics. But we are in a seriously bad place.
Darby, one of the last points you made there is super important, is that the state of things also has an impact on the politics of our time.
Yeah.
And when you talk politics, one has to look at the issue of ideology.
Yeah.
It seems as though in this country, ideology drives decision making, and not pragmatism, not what needs to happen, but what is my particular worldview, regardless of what the data is telling me, regardless of what the metrics are. Why is this a problem as we head into the politics issue?
Yeah, I will agree with you, but I also want to disagree with you. And let me tell you why I say so. Yes, ideologically, South Africa is pretty much split in two. You get the lefts and the rights. And if you want to define it, we're going to get into a debate of what's what. But let's sort of say that the lefties are the guys that believe in group rights, and the righties are the guys that believe in individual rights.
Right.
Or the lefties are the guys that believe that the state should be strong and big, and the righties are the guys that believe that the state should be small and weak. So that's more or less the differences I get. Or private ownership, the right guys, the righties, they believe that the individual should have private property rights, while the lefties believe that property rights should be in the hands of the state. So that's, and I don't want to get into a debate because I'm making a lot of mistakes, but let's call that left and right.
Just a quick bookmark. Do you mind just speaking a little closer to
the
mic so we get rid of the echo?
Yeah. So but I think we understand what is left and right. And that used to be the case in South Africa. It was pretty clear to understand what's left and what's right. We had the commies and the ANC on the left, and then we had sort of the right on the left, rest on the right, although pretty a lot of the guys on the right were actually on the left. I'm
pretty
referring
much
to the previous National Party,
pretty
for
much
example. They were actually on the left. But it doesn't matter. The point I want to make is when the ANC took over as government in South Africa, they were coming from the left, and they turned themselves into what I would call a new liberalist kind of political party, and they did all sort of new liberalist kind of stuff. Like, for example, they liberalized the trade and the labor markets, and they privatized. I mean, that's a swear word today in the ANC at least. So that was the beginning of the ANC. Pretty soon they changed direction again, and today the ANC is something else. Can you call the ANC today an ideological organization? And I don't think so. I think that they have ideological roots. If you listen to them, they talk ideology. They use all sort of ideological excuses to do certain things, like the nationalization of the Reserve Bank because it must belong to the people or whatever. So they use the language of the left, but that's not what it is. The ANC today is not left or right or ideologically driven mostly. The ANC today is one massive big patronage. It's become a huge network that is dependent on the state. They've lost their ideology. They don't even believe in ideology. They believe in one thing, is that you have to belong to this group, and that the state is there for the taking. And with the state, I mean everything. That is the national departments and the local authorities and the state-owned enterprises and the like. And that's what the ANC is today. Mm-hmm. And that is why it's going to be so extremely difficult for the Minister of Finance to cut back on state spending, because this thing that we call the ANC and the Tripartite Alliance, this depends, its existence depends on state spending. Mm. Because that's what they live off. They live off the money that belongs to you and me, actually. But they live off that. So it's not an ideological thing. It's like a parasite that we have to keep on feeding.
I think any South African taxpayer listening to you just goes, absolutely, Davi, I fully agree with you. And because we see this, don't we, in real terms, where there are these individuals who are dead set on holding on to their position, their proximity, if you will, to government. And with government, of course, we're talking government contracts and all these wonderful trappings. Let's dig into this now in real terms of how we've seen this practically. Davi, we're in trouble as a nation. There are 200 plus state-owned enterprises in this country. Obviously, we hear of the big ones, Eskom, SAA, but there's essentially 200 plus. Speaking to exactly what you talk about, which is with there being so many SOEs, there must very well be very many people who eat off of them, so to speak, eat in inverted commas. But let's talk about the bigger ones, the ones that are sort of putting us into a lot of trouble. Eskom right now, new CEO, on paper, everything looks like it's sort of on the right track. But when you look at the numbers, 400 billion rand debt, 20 billion rand year-on-year debt that it builds on and on and on, is this sustainable? What prevents us from making the right decisions around not only Eskom, but something like SAA 2, et cetera, et cetera?
The last couple of months, I saw this whole drama taking another turn. For the worse or for the better, depending how you look at that. Let's look at South African Airways, because what happened the past couple of years, of a couple of months with South African Airways is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Now, South African Airways has been kept alive by you and me, the taxpayer, artificially. We've been transferring tens of billions of rands to South African Airways. They are relatively small, just by the way. Now, they kept on doing that. Now, let me give a couple of names here. The guy that had been transferring huge amounts of money while he was the Minister of Finance was Pravin Gordhan.
That's right.
The guy that everybody thinks walks on water.
Yeah.
He was the guy, and while he was the Minister of Finance, state finances were run into the ground. Of course, it's not only his fault.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't think he had his hand in a cookie jar. Okay, I think he's clean. But he's a commie, and he believes in the centralization of power and to keep things alive that shouldn't be alive like South African Airways. Now he's the Minister of State-Owned Enterprises, and he was the guy interfering at Eskom and the South African Airways and other state-owned enterprises when they tried to fix, when good guys like Hadebe, for example, tried to fix Eskom, he prevented them from doing that. So he interfered there. So it was, again, political interference happening here. But the interesting thing about South African Airways, so they mismanaged the thing, there was bailouts after bailouts after bailouts, and eventually they put it into business rescue. But it wasn't, I know Pravin Gordhan says, it was him. It's not true. It's not him. It wasn't him. It was actually one of the trade unions applied for business rescue, and Pravin Gordhan lost all the initiative, of course. He said, okay, well, I'm going to put it into, but it wasn't him. He was pushed into doing this. Now they've got it. Business rescue, South African Airways on a business rescue, and the idea with business rescue is to fix this thing or to liquidate it, essentially. That is what it means. And what did they do? They transferred. And that is another bailout. They give it other names. They say it is the development bank, Nogal, giving them money. What's developmental about that? And the state, you and I, we again guarantee it's another bailout to a business that is under business rescue. And then the ANC said, we're going to revive South African Airways. It is important for A, B, and C reasons, and we're just waiting for the radical change of the business rescue, and then it will. Then it's business as usual. And again, billions of rands that we have to use. So the interesting thing that's happening here, obviously, they don't learn their lessons. I don't understand why. How can you have 10 turnaround plans at South African Airways? Here's the opportunity to get rid of this thing. We have business rescue. And what did they do? Give it another bailout and promise they're going to revive it. I mean, I just cannot get my head around it.
Let's look at it in context. And you're spot on, by the way. You have a situation where, Davi, if I'm the president of this country, and I'm in this organization called the ANC, which you rightly described as now being a patronage network. The idea that the closer you are to power and those who are in power, the better your chances, if you're a tenderpreneur, whatever the case may be, to eat off of the state. I think your first hand was spot on. I'm not going to relinquish something like SAA. I'm not something basically that has this ability to have mega contracts, big contracts, catering contracts, repair contracts, SAA technical, etc., etc. The underlying service itself may be very good. I mean, if you fly SAA, you know, you're not going to have any problems necessarily unless it's late or delayed or cancelled.
But don't talk about that. I had 3 flights cancelled last week, South African Airways. Never going to fly them again, I promise you.
But I mean, for someone who's sitting in the seat in SAA, there's no discernible difference.
No.
But the problem is, you are literally running this thing off of fumes. You're running it off of debt. And South Africans don't fully understand, I think, the concept of debt and sovereign debt in particular, the idea of the government running up this debt. They somehow think, no, someone else kind of pays for it, or the market, in inverted commas, pays for it. And we don't see the link yet that all those decisions that a Praveen makes as a finance minister of racking up more debt, the consequences of which fall on me, not the politicians, me, the citizen, who coughs out of my tax.
And I can give you a couple of numbers here. That and again, let's talk about this thing that we call the economy. The idea of the economy is that we measure all the things that are produced in the economy, and all goods are like bags of millions of tins of beans and services, and there are many different services, and there are some definitions. So economists got a set of rules, and we say everything that falls into this is part of the economy, and we produce stuff in the economy. Quite often what economists also do, we express many things as a percentage of this thing that we call the economy. Like, for example, if I produce on a farm 100 bags of millies, but I owe 10 bags of millies, then that means 10 bags to 100 is my debt. Okay, that's a simple example. So that's what economists do. We look at the state and how much money the state owns and how much the money the state borrows every year, and we express that as a percentage of GDP. Now, it's easy to understand. If the economy doesn't grow, and if the economy gets smaller, in fact, then this ratio is moving in the wrong direction, because it's a ratio, debt to GDP, as an example. Now, let me give you the numbers. When Pravin Gordhan took over as the Minister of Finance, state debt levels was around about 25% of GDP. When I talk about state debt, I talk about the specific definition, and this is so-called national government. It's in the so-called the main budget of the Minister of Finance. So that then there's more than to that, like, for example, the state-owned enterprises, but I'll get to that later. So state debt was around about 25% to GDP when he took over as Minister of Finance. Today's state debt is relative to GDP, and the current financial year is going to end at around about 65% to GDP. And that's in a matter of 10 years. This is massive. Every year, the state debt to GDP ratio in the current environment is going up by 5%. So we're going to end to 65% to GDP. Next year is going to be 70% to GDP. The year thereafter, 75% plus. Now you have to pay interest on last year's borrowing as well. And the fiscal deficit just keeps on getting bigger and bigger. And if the economy contracts during that time, it will get even bigger. So we are in a fiscal debt spiral, in a fiscal debt trap. So how do you fix this? You fix it, and remember, I have not included Eskom yet. It should be included, and other things, the other parasitals. So how do you fix this? You fix it by doing one or two things. Well, it will be, of course, it will be nice if the economy can grow by 10%, then of course, it doesn't matter.
Yes.
You can do all sorts of silly things, and the economy grows, it's fine. But in the current environment, the economy isn't growing. So what can you do? You have to spend less, or you have to get more money in. So spend less, and that's why the politics come in. Means inevitably one or two things, and that is you have to spend less money on people, salaries, and fewer people employed. And you have to spend less money on bailing out the state-owned enterprises. That's the only place. You can't really cut back on things like, for example, infrastructure, because you hardly spend anything on infrastructure. Or you have to increase your revenue, and that means more taxes. So this is what's going to happen. The ANC, like we said, is one massive patronage. It's dependent on state money being spent. So cutting that is going to be extremely difficult, because that's not in the nature of the ANC. They want money to be spent. That leaves you with only one option, and that's more taxes. So let me, and I'll write this on a piece of paper and sign next to it. There will be tax increases. I don't know exactly which ones, but there will be tax increases on the fuel levy, for example, on the various sin taxes and things like that. There could be, and there's most likely going to be, increases in personal income taxes, the biggest tax, by the way, 40% of our total tax take. And they can do it through various means. They can increase the percentage tax, or they can simply do nothing, and the effect of inflation will push you, the so-called fiscal drag. And there may even be an increase in value-added taxes as well, which is politically extremely difficult to do. And there's even talk, Kusatu, those economic illiterate guys. But Kusatu suggested that we have to increase company taxes. Now that is the silliest, the most, that's a stupid idea. Because companies don't pay tax. Yes. Companies always shift their completely, the total tax burden down to the individuals.
Yes.
And in effect, individuals pay all taxes and in. So the point is, because of the nature of the ANC and what it has become, they are dependent on state money, and as long as they can get money out of your my pocket, they will keep on taking money out of my pocket. Interesting. Tito Mboweni, ideologically, is certainly not there. He's a part of the ANC. He's been saying, close down the South African Airways, doing A, B, and C, and so on. He's been saying these sort of things. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit, but I think he's a lone voice in the wilderness here. I don't think he's going to last.
Perhaps before we get there, because there was a segment where I said, surely there must be some silver linings, and I think Tito's kind of
one,
and Saab's one, but we'll get there just now, two sort of questions from now. Let's go back. You raised a very interesting equation, which I don't think we quite see, which is the idea that there must be growth in a society if you will be then able to foot the bill, so to speak, of a bulky government as we have it now. Then the leftist comes in, Davi, and says, well, Davi Rhodes is wrong. We have our own economists who basically say that you don't have to worry about debt in a society. You don't have to worry about certain fundamentals. And here's the big kicker. You don't have to worry about growth. So long as the state takes more control of things in society, we create more SOEs, we create more government jobs and the like, then everything will be fine, Darby, surely.
Let me refine your argument a little bit further, or this leftish argument. Now, there are many arguments sort of similar in the following vein, more or less. But the one argument is that we need to spend, the state needs to spend more money. And by the way, it started with a guy that was seen one of the greatest economists of all time. His name is John Maynard. Lord, I think he was. Anyway, he basically said that during times of economic slowdown, the state should spend more money to get the economy going. And once the economy grows, then of course the state must do the opposite and reduce its spending, which never happens.
Mm-hmm.
That is simple terms. So what the politicians always only read the one side of the story that suits them. So whenever the economy stops growing, they spend more money. When the economy starts growing, they spend even more. That's what they do. And of course, if you keep on doing that, then you're going to get into trouble eventually. Yes. And that is unfortunately what they misunderstand. If that argument holds, then why can't we just spend ourselves rich?
Yes.
And you can't do that. Remember, wealth is something that is produced. Something that is produced like bags of millions or computers or cars or whatever what we produce. And the way that we spend money in South Africa, for example, if the state spends a lot of money and you give the money to the civil servants, what they do, they buy flat screen TVs and fancy cars, and many of these things are simply importing. So that's one simple example why it doesn't work. Because we import stuff.
Right.
So if we spend a lot of money, if the state spends a lot of money, we're simply going to stimulate the Chinese economy and not the South African economy. Mm-hmm. So that's one. So no, there's a lot of absolutely BS to think that the state can get this economy growing by simply just spending more and more money.
Mm-hmm.
But because also, every cent that they spend, they take out of your pocket. So it might be the case that the state take the money, spend it more on a civil servant, and he buys some Kentucky somewhere. But the money has been taken out of your pocket, and you can't buy the Kentucky anymore.
Exactly.
So don't think there's a free lunch. There is no free lunch. By the way, there's one free lunch. Maybe we can talk about that.
No, but I think you lay out a very strong case in terms of the fallacy of, you know, the spend your way out of trouble situation, because you see this quite a lot, unfortunately,
all the time
in our economics. And worse yet, and I won't mention any names because I know your economics community is a small one, you know, there are quite a few economists who are linked and who work with and who have the ear of our politicians who are actually pushing this sort of nonsense into that space. And it's actually quite troubling, and I call them out on social media quite a lot, but that's a separate debate for another day. Davi, as we sort of move the conversation along, because you've set out quite importantly why the politics is a problem, why the ideology and really the kleptocracy, essentially,
yeah,
I'll give it a word,
it is, yeah.
is driving the sort of insistence on keeping and maintaining a status quo, even though it's self-harming or it's self-harm, essentially. And you've raised the specter of why, if we don't get the growth story right, that nothing, regardless of what your ideological view is, nothing works out for a society in that situation. Let's take the conversation to its logical conclusion. The World Bank issues out some its forecasts for where our growth will be. Our own economist in-house at the IRR, Ian Cruickshanks, laughs that off and basically says that's not happening, given the trajectory of where we are at the moment. And you've got a smile on your face. I think you might be on the same page, Ian, and I'll unleash you on this topic. Davi, here's the direct question. What happens to us if we don't get the growth story right?
Well, okay, let's see what the potential for the South African economy, what we can grow at. And I've done my own numbers, and I can show you how I've done this, but the World Bank did say, yes, just below 1%, the IMF more or less in line with that. Many other institutions, the Reserve Bank has been cutting down on their estimates. We're going to see what the Minister of Finance is going to say. I can promise you he's going to cut back on his estimates as well. And here's my number. I believe that South Africa in the current environment has got a growth ceiling. Now, note, I'm not saying this is what we're going to grow at. The growth ceiling currently in South Africa is less than 1%. That means even if we do everything right, the economy will not grow by 1%. And the reason is simple, because we don't have electricity. I'm not even talking about the other stuff. I'm not talking about the dysfunction of the state-owned enterprises and the excessive tax burden and the incompetence of the civil service and stuff. I'm just looking at electricity. If you don't, it doesn't matter if we invest and build factories and mines and things like that. If you don't have electricity, your economy will not grow. So that's a starting point. 1% maximum growth if we do everything right. Believe me, we're not going to do everything right. We're going to do a lot of bad things. SAA is one example. So if you keep on doing stuff badly or wrong decisions, then this 1% will go down and down and down, and we're probably going to see 0.5% growth this year again or even less in an environment, again, where the population is growing at 1.5%, 1.6% or so. So where is this going to end? This is how these sort of things always end the same. What happens is politicians the state starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger, the tax burden increase. Then what happens is that if you run out of taxpayers, what you do next, you start consuming your capital. Or you don't look after your capital. That is the same as consuming capital. Eskom, another one. It's been destroyed. And then you run out of capital eventually, then you have to find money somewhere else. And the obvious place is to find money in that pot of gold that is left, and that's the savers. Have you heard of prescribed assets? That's it. And then the fourth one, this party always ends the same. Once you run out of savers, you go after the one thing that still remains, and that's your central bank. And that means inflation.
This is where I want us to go. You've preempted my question. As I said before, we get to the silver lining. You clearly see this now. The South African politician, who I now call the predatory politician, has become a predator. And firmly in his sights, like a cheetah chasing an impala in the field, you know, sort of zigging when we zig, zagging when we zag, is the South African saver, the pensioner, inevitably, with you mentioning the prescribed assets policy. And of course, other forms of saving, you know, household savings by way of someone who maybe literally bought a house and, you know, is contributing towards it. That is a form of saving
of course
to an extent. That's also under threat with policies such as expropriation
without compensation. Exactly. Yes.
The moral of the story, very simply, is the predatory politician is now firmly set his eyes on the saver. Davi, here's the conundrum, and I want you to talk to this. When the saver himself is leaving the country.
That's the next point.
And by the way, there's two levels of leaving the country. There's that the richer saver who takes his money and financially immigrates. Yeah, he might be here. You might still see him in the mansion. But financially, he's not here.
No.
He's in wherever. And of course, there's the more average Joe, like, you know, Mbali and I. Mbali is my sound person over here. You know, we don't have that kind of money. But we're starting to do things like planning, for example, because we're young, for us to physically leave the country.
Yeah.
Often taking skills, taking the ability to pay these taxes that the politicians need with us to other countries. Talk to me about that problem that we're facing.
The problem you're referring to is people running away, voting with their feet. You know, and we in South Africa, we've got something called foreign exchange regulations. You can't just take money out of South Africa. You have to jump through a lot of hoops before you are allowed to take money out. And that's what I do here in this business. You're allowed to take R1 million out. It's quite fairly easy to do that. If you want to take anything more than that out, you have to get special permission from bureaucrats. Now, imagine this. I work hard. I pay my taxes, and I'm totally overtaxed. I do all these things that are required from me. And now I want to take my money that I have worked for, and I want to take it out of the country for whatever reason, and now I have to go and stand in a queue and ask a bureaucrat to take my own money out of the country. And this is something that I'm concerned about as well. So we have foreign exchange regulations. People are taking the money out all the time, and that, by the way, is part of the reason why the South African currency, the rand, is so very, very, very weak, because nobody wants it. We don't want to put our money in South Africa. We want to take it out because we can see the mess that is caused by the politicians. And I've got a suspicion that opportunity will be closing down as well. But I'm saying, I think foreign exchange regulations may be something that the politicians will eventually start considering as well, because if the money is out, of course, they can't lay their hands on it.
That's right. And it's funny, for legal reasons, I won't say what I want to say in real terms. I think what I'm trying to say in a legal way, but although it's illegal, is that actually South Africans are finding ways now to move their money out, including not so rich South Africans, by the way. But again, this conversation, after I've consulted with my lawyers, I'll have in another podcast with someone who can talk to us about this particular issue. But Davi, I digress. The concern, therefore, with the picture you've painted is poor growth and a growth ceiling, which is a scary thing to think about. No electricity, a declining standard of living for most South Africans, a country which is seemingly losing the battle on crime, therefore things are getting miserable for most people who are hashtag I'm staying, and essentially a body politic which ever increasingly seeks to leech off of these individuals, these unhappy, barely making it individuals, and don't see on their side what they like to ask us to do, which is to tighten our belts.
Exactly.
We're not really seeing them doing this. I'm going to move to that one last area that you mentioned. Once the politician says, I'm coming after your savings, once the savings are depleted, he then says, hey, no one's here who's willing to give me the money. How about I print the money myself? How is this a problem, and what am I referring to in particular?
We're seeing it already. We have an institution called the South African Reserve Bank. It's a statutory monopoly, by the way, and they can literally make money. And they can make money out of nothing. And that whoever's in charge of that machine, that printing machine that can create money out of nothing, is of course a very, very powerful individual. And that's the reason why we have in our constitution the independence of the central bank is guaranteed. And that's the reason, by the way, why there were some suggestions made by brilliant economists like H. Magashule, for example, that they want to nationalize the Reserve Bank, which is not necessarily a main issue, but they want to change the mandate of the Reserve Bank. That means this is code language for let's start printing money. Anyway, one of the best things that the president has done, a brilliant thing, is to reappoint Lesetja Konyango as the governor of the Reserve Bank. He's one of the best governors that we've ever had, if not the best. He's supposed to have two jobs. Now he's got three jobs. Let me start with the job that he's not supposed to have. He's not supposed to protect the independence of the Reserve Bank from the attacks from the politicians. And he's taking a lot of time. He's defending the Reserve Bank, and we have to support him in that. That shouldn't be his job. But that is, in fact, what is happening. Politicians are interfering and meddling and trying to prescribe to the Reserve Bank what to do. The second thing that he's supposed to do is get inflation down mechanically. And he's done that. I would like to see it even lower. But he's done that. Excellent. Doing an excellent job. That meant that he had to keep interest rates relatively high for some time. And he's done that now. And the third thing is, he needs to get inflation expectations down. And he's done that as well. Because now we trust him. We believe him. When he says, listen, you guys, we're going to get inflation down to 4.5%. Not the 6% like we used to, because we had the 3-6% band. We still have that. But he says, now I want to target 4.5%. We should be targeting too, if you ask me. And now we believe him because he's proved himself. And that's what money is. Money is nothing but trust.
Yes.
And Lesetja Konyango, market trust him.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is where I'm saying the conversation is heading, isn't it? There are two broad active in the finance world and the economics world who are building that trust with the public to varying degrees, but Lesego being the highest of the two.
Without a doubt.
Absolutely. And you're right. Look, I'm not in favor of fiat currencies generally, but that's another
debate. That's another debate.
But in so far as we have a fiat currency, yeah, we have a central bank, absolutely. You've got to have a character like Lesego who's brave enough at times to even stand against political principles and say, actually, no, I'm not here to listen to you. I'm not here to heed your populist message. My job is to protect the integrity of the South African saver, the South African individual.
But imagine the kind of pressure that he's under. Remember, just about everybody, I'm not even talking about lefties only.
Yeah.
I'm not even talking about the trade unions and these funny communists and all that. I'm talking about mainstream economists saying that the Reserve Bank is doing. Remember, we have to pay a price in order to earn the trust. That's a price we paid. Mm. And the price was relatively high interest rates. Mm. We didn't, because imagine that what South Africa would have looked like if we had just about zero economic growth plus inflation of 20%. This would have been a complete, total disaster.
Mm,
but fortunately, there's one guy, and I'm afraid that he's going to be there for another 5 years, thankfully so. So he will, and I'm pretty sure he's going to do this, he will keep on defending the independence of the Reserve Bank. But I'm just very, very worried to know who's going to take over from him. If there's some weird things happening on the political sphere, and remember, it's the state president appointing the governor at the South African Reserve Bank, and I can think of a couple of state presidents that I wouldn't want to be there.
Sort of literally waiting in the wings, aren't they? Let's move the conversation on a little bit as we sort of tie things up a bit. That second silver lining, maybe not as big as Lesego, but he's there, tweets a lot about his cooking from his private farm, which hopefully he will not have expropriated without his being compensated. That was a little dig, yes, I know. The finance minister, you mentioned this earlier, he has been making, to his credit, he has been making the right noises around the need to abandon ideological thinking and actually say, guys, what works, what do we need to do, and we need to do it urgently.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. In a few weeks, he's going to be addressing the nation around the budget. And you made mention already that those numbers are not going to look good.
Horrible.
Talk to me about what you think from this individual who has a little bit of our trust. What is he going to stand up in there and tell us, Darby?
Well, let's see what's been happening in the last couple of months and years. I think I had a look at the political climate, or who's in charge of the ANC, I guess is a better question. And I see four centers of power. Of course, there are more, but four major centers of power. The one is the president and Pravin Gordhan. The other one is the deputy president, and he seems to be sort of wherever the most money is. He seems to be a bit like a hired gun. See what happened when he was elected. The third one is Ace Magashule, and it seems to be the ex-Zumaites is around there, more or less. And the fourth one is Tito Mboweni. Now, I've had the privilege of having a couple of short ones with Tito a few times. I think he's an amazing guy. He's a bit of a maverick. He's got a serious, well, he hasn't got an image problem, put it that way. But I really do like him. I really do like him because he used to be the governor of the South African Reserve Bank. Once he's put his head on something, I think he really will really do whatever he can to achieve that. He understands the financial markets, and I think he's the best that the ANC can offer. And I'm afraid he's going to say one day, listen, you guys, I've been trying, I've been saying no, you cannot do this. It's not a matter of ideology, it's a matter of simply sums. It's the numbers, they do not add up. And I've got a suspicion, either he's going to jump or he's going to get pushed. I can't see how he's going to stick around for that much longer. And even the president himself have been knocking him over the knuckles and saying, listen, we don't agree with that. So I'm afraid. Tito is another silver lining. But I think he's going to start looking after these.
I want to quickly interject here. These individuals have just been at Davos, and they got a bloody nose, so to speak, to an extent, insofar as if I'm to judge off of one economic anchor, a journalist, clearly,
yeah.
Davi, the international community is just not buying the nonsense from South Africa anymore. And you need, unfortunately, if that's the case, if there is a trust deficit with the international community, you need to put your best foot forward. Not the finance minister, because I've seen his shoes, so he can keep his feet backward. But the finance minister, in terms of his character, who he is, and that individual, do you think, I'm asking a political question now, do you think the ANC would really risk getting rid of someone like that who they need essentially to push forward into the international community.
I said earlier in this discussion that the ANC has turned into this parasitic institution. They need money to, that's what they need. And I'm afraid they will get rid of anybody that stands in the way of the ANC. So I am afraid it's probably, yes, they will get rid, if necessary, they will get rid of anybody, as long as they can maintain this whole thing, this whole patronage. And let me just add to this. I get the opportunity to speak to international, to diplomats quite a lot. I've had the opportunity to dine with prime ministers even in South Africa, and diplomats and ambassadors quite a lot. And journalists, of course, and international investors, and I go abroad once every now and again as well, and I speak a lot to the local investors in South Africa, and I've got a bit of a dilemma. Let me just share this with you. It's a bit of a personal problem, because when I stand in front of a lot of potential investors, and they ask me about South Africa, my question to myself is, what should I be? Should I be a South African, or should I be an analyst? Should I be a loyal South African, telling them, should I lie to them, or should I be an honest analyst? That's a dilemma, because I want this country to work. And I can tell you, they ask me questions, they ask me to explain to them things like, for example, what's happening to South African Airways. And I try to tell them this, and they say, what? What? Is that how you do stuff in South Africa? What? Or they ask questions. So who's in jail? Who's in jail? So now I'm afraid that the image of South Africa internationally is not what it is. But if they want to really want to sell South Africa, Tito is the right guy. But I'm afraid he's going to say, we're going to cut back on state spending and wastage and corruption and blah, blah, blah. Next year he's going to be there again, and we haven't done anything. They're going to stop listening to him as well.
Darby, as we really look to wrap up this conversation in the sort of last 5 minutes we have, I wanted to talk to me, just to bring the question back a little bit, to this budget that's coming up, because I think anybody who's listening to us now is chomping at the bit. Please, 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 what do you expect out of this budget? You sort of began earlier on, and I'm going to frame it this way.
Yeah.
Tax will be the big story of this budget. Spending, do you think, and maybe there's a secondary question, do you think we're going to see a message of cutting back on spending, a meaningful one? And the last question is, what happens with the civil service? Will it shrink? Will it be... Sorry, little technical glitch. Give me a second, people, as I quickly fix this. Okay, we're back. We're back. There's three broad areas I want you to speak to as we close this conversation. Okay. Tax, good tax versus bad tax. What's about to happen? Two, spending. Will we see the state say, no, we're going to roll back spending in order to service debt and blah, blah, blah? And three, what happens with the civil service?
Okay, let's talk a little bit about taxes, because that is the stuff that I really like to talk about, and I keep an eye on what's going on the various taxes, and that tells you a lot about what's going on in the economy. There are three major taxes. The most important tax is personal income taxes, and remember, civil servants also pay personal income taxes, and every year there are nearly 30,000 civil servants that are paid R1 million. 30,000 civil servants. But they also pay personal income tax. So personal income tax is the most important tax to the Minister of Finance, about 40% of total tax take. And the personal income taxes is very, very skewed. It's a relatively few individuals that pay by far most the personal income taxes. It's a very, very skewed personal income tax profile that we have in South Africa. The second most important tax is value-added tax. It's an indirect tax, and that's a tax on spending. And that has been under some pressure recently as well. That used to do quite well, the collection of on value-added taxes, because if you spend a lot of money on the civil servants, they buy Kentucky and flat-screen TVs, and we pay VAT and all of that. So the more you spend on the civil service, the more personal income taxes they pay, and the more VAT they pay as well. The third most important tax is company taxes, around about 16% of total tax. And that tax has been under pressure for quite a number of years. And that is the tax that gives us the better indication of underlying economic activity. So for some, and we could see this in personal income. And then a couple of other smaller taxes like the fuel levy and the sin taxes and the stuff. So the revenue, the total revenue in my estimates in the current financial year could be between 60 and as much as 80 or even more billion rand less than the original budgeted estimate. That's a billion with a B. On the spending side, Spending is going to be more. Fortunately, we have something called the contingency reserve. We're going to use that and other things. But spending is probably going to be more because of things like, for example, the bailouts on state-owned enterprises and the like. But here's the trick that politicians quite often use. So they guarantee a spending on South African Airways, but it's not part of expense. So it's not part of the spending numbers necessarily, but it increases the potential debt because it's only a guarantee. So watch out for that sort of numbers. But anyway, so the difference between the two, the fiscal deficit, how much we spend and how much we get in, is probably going to be around about 7% of GDP, and we spoke about that, and that will add to the already tax burden, and eventually it's going to lead, to the debt burden, and eventually it's going to lead to a downgrade. So that's where we are. And I'm afraid the downgrade is pretty much a given. I can't see how we're going to get out of this one. That will lead to a weaker currency initially. I'm actually quite bullish on the currency, by the way. One of the reasons is because South African financial markets is very liquid, very attractive, and the currency is already very weak. But over time, the rand will keep on losing value, but in the short term, it could turn around a little bit as speculators come in. But I do believe a downgrade is pretty much a given. And until we start really pulling up our socks, and until the president, I think it must start with the president, and unless he starts taking leadership, because he's not. Unless that happens, I'm afraid we're going to keep on the current downward spiral.
Absolutely. Well, okay, as we are in our final minute, Darby, you've painted, unfortunately, a picture, a very dark picture, but I like leaving our listeners with asking my guest the top five reforms that you would suggest if we are really going to turn the ship, turn the tide. Top five reforms, Darby, what do we do?
All right, let me just, before I get to the top, let me just make one or two comments. I did say that South Africa's, the yields in South Africa, look at the capital markets, for example, is very attractive, and the currency is very weak. That is a plus for us, because I suspect that foreigners will see that there are very nice opportunities, especially in the financial markets, so don't necessarily think the rand's going to fall completely out of the bus. And what I'm also trying to say, if you've got nice yields in the capital market, there are other nice yields in the rest of the economy as well. So if you're a business person, you must do two things. Identify your risks and manage your risks, and the money will come. So don't lose hope. Okay, a couple of things that you need to do in South Africa. First of all, I think what needs to happen is that the ANC government must say and stand up and say, listen, we made a big mess of this thing. We must admit it's our fault, because it is their fault. Stand up and say that, and also tell us that we're going to lead from now on. I am the president. I have got a vision for South Africa. I'm going to lead this country, and tell us it is going to be tough, and it's going to be very, very difficult. Point number two, you have to cut back on state spending.
Absolutely.
You must spend less money, because there is not more money. The taxpayer cannot keep on carrying this burden. Point number three, and this is perhaps the most important one, we will do whatever is necessary to protect the individual private property rights.
Absolutely.
We will not steal private property rights. We will, and point number four, we will make sure from now on is that the anybody that steals money will end up in jail. The politicians primarily. And the most important thing, if you're a politician, you are a civil servant. And from now on, we will have an effective and efficient civil service, with the emphasis on the service part.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is Mr. Darby Roux from the Efficient Group, of course, who has literally just broken it down for us as to just how, on the one hand, how much of a mess we're in, of course, but as I always do at the end of the show, like what we can actually do to get ourselves back. And when you listen to something like that, I need you to situate yourself in that. Don't think you're a passive recipient of these reforms. You need to be the loudest voice in the room in fighting for those ideas, fighting for, to lobby your local politician to move in that direction. So a quick hearty thank you very much to Darby Roux. Darby, thank you very much for joining me.
An absolute pleasure and an absolute honor.
Thanks, homie. I appreciate that. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to this episode of Liberty and Friends. Remember, you can always support your favorite fat boy by becoming a friend of the IRR. That is our crowdfunding campaign. That is literally where I get my salary from. So don't think I'm rolling in the Jacob Zuma dough type situation here. No, I'm not a tenderpreneur. I don't make that kind of money. I'm wholly dependent on you. You can become a friend by essentially donating 90 rand a month to the campaign. How How do you do that, you're wondering? Well, SMS your name to 32823, and SMS will cost you 1 rand. Terms and conditions do apply. And of course, if you're in new school, you're hip, you're young, well then find us online rather at irr.org.za/join, and you can sign up to donate 90 rand a month over there. Guys, thank you so much for listening to the show. Remember, as I always say, never trust a commie.